wishing that your day will be a
Today is Thursday, February 18th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Thousands flood the street of Myanmar as protests against the February 1st coup continue.
Deadly violence in Myanmar could soon erupt. That is the stark warning from the United Nations.
Plus, Zanzibar's Saif Sharif Hamad dies after being hospitalized for COVID-19.
He became the first person to declare his COVID-19 status in Tanzania since April 29, 2020.
And Uganda's opposition party petitions the UN Human Rights Office. We'll have these stories and more next. Thousands flooded Myanmar's largest city on Wednesday, staging demonstrations that shut down the streets in Yangon. This is the third week of protests following a military coup that jailed leaders of the democratically elected party that won power in November. VOA's Arasha Rabasadi starts us off.
Deadly violence in Myanmar could soon erupt. That is the stark warning from the United Nations as protests roared into a third week after the military staged a coup and jailed members of the National League for Democracy Party led by Aung San Suu Kyi. The military, led by Senior General Min Aung Hlaing, refuses to back down despite U.S. President Joe Biden boosting sanctions on the junta's top brass. Protester Ki PR, who is a former NLD lawmaker, says the people have no choice but to take the streets.
In the military's press conference yesterday, they said that the number of protesters will reduce gradually. This upset the people. We are not weak. We will never step back in the fight against the military regime.
Protesters blocked security vehicles with their cars opening their hoods to claim engine trouble.
The cars here are broken down and suddenly stopped due to the suffering that our people are undergoing now. We just stopped the cars here on the road to show that we do not want the military regime. Cars have broken down and stopped all over the streets.
The military alleged widespread fraud in last November's general elections, which Aung San Suu Kyi's party won in a landslide. They first charged her with violating the country's import-export laws and, more recently, a national disaster law. The increased military presence in major cities has the United Nations warning of imminent escalation that could turn violent. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
The first vice president of Tanzania's Zanzibar Island, Saif Sharif Hamad, died on Wednesday morning after announcing that he had been hospitalized with COVID-19. President John Magufuli, who claims that there are no coronavirus cases in Tanzania, despite mounting evidence, issued condolences without mentioning the cause of death. Charles Kumpi takes it from here.
The cause of death has not been made public, but on January 31, Hamad was hospitalized in the archipelago after testing positive for COVID-19. He became the first person to declare his COVID-19 status in Tanzania since April 29, 2020. On a Twitter post, Tanzania's President John Magufuli sent his condolences to the Zanzibar's president and the people of Zanzibar, saying he was saddened by Hamad's passing. As COVID-19 information in the country is still unclear, the big question is whether the government will reveal the cause of his death. Charles Kombe, for VOA News, Dar es Salaam, Tanzania.
The terrorism trial of the man who inspired the film Hotel Rwanda began on Wednesday. His lawyers argue that a Rwandan court cannot try him because he's no longer a citizen and assert that he was kidnapped and is being held hostage by authorities. Reuters' Soraya Ali reports.
Rusase Bagina, the hotelier depicted as a hero in a Hollywood movie about Rwanda's 1994 genocide, was charged with terrorism-related offenses in a Kigali court on Wednesday at the start of a trial that has drawn international scrutiny. Rusase Bagina, who achieved fame through the film Hotel Rwanda, wore a prison-issue pink shirt as he appeared in court, where he faces 9 charges, including forming an illegal armed group, being a member of a terrorist group, and sponsoring terrorism. His family says the critic of President Paul Kagame is in poor health and that his trial is a sham. Rwanda's government says he has fomented violence and directed deadly attacks on its territory from exile. During pre-trial hearings, Rusase Begina said he had been abducted while visiting Dubai last year and forcibly returned to Rwanda. His lawyer argued that the court does not have jurisdiction.
I would like to insist on the fact that Rusase Begina is in Rwanda illegally. He did not come following an extradition. He didn't even come of his own free will. He found himself in Rwanda against his will.
Rusase Begina was not required to enter a plea on Wednesday. The judge said he will rule on whether the court has jurisdiction on February 26th.
Soraya Ali reports for Reuters News. Uganda's opposition National Unity Platform Party has petitioned the UN Human Rights Office over alleged human rights violations and state-inspired abductions. Relatives say their loved ones remain missing after they disappeared in the lead-up to January's contested election. Uganda's President Yoweri Museveni, who was re-elected to a sixth term, has called the abduction reports false and claims only terrorists were arrested. Halima Athumani is up next.
The National Unity Platform Party headquarters was filled Wednesday with relatives of people who have been reported missing before, during, and after the January elections. Crying mothers and former abducted young men narrated their tales amid some tears. Ayebare Halima is a mother of two, including a three-week-old infant. She tells how on January 24th, seven police officers went to her home and arrested her at gunpoint. She was then taken to police headquarters in Naguru, where she was threatened and questioned about the whereabouts of her husband, Kenneth Mukasa Seguya. She says she was pregnant when police officers questioned her. Once they were done, she says they told her to go home, but warned that if they failed to find her husband, they would arrest her instead. She says 3 days later, her husband called and told her he had been arrested. Ayemere says her husband was then brought home, and police officers took People Power branded T-shirts, some jackets, and red berets. She said they then left and took her husband, and she still doesn't know where he is or even if he's alive. Ayemere says one of the arresting officers gave her a number she could call if she wanted to know where her husband was being taken. When she called, however, the officer who answered then insulted her and warned her never to call the number again. National Unity Platform officials report that more than 300 of their members countrywide remain missing. It is for this reason the party president, Robert Kyagulanyi, better known as Bobi Wine, is petitioning the United Nations Human Rights Office in Kampala. He says it is painful that Ugandans have no local human rights institution that can come to their rescue.
John Museveni feels like Uganda is his compound, Uganda is his property. He has the right to pick and kill anybody at his will. He has the right to torture anybody, to murder anybody, but we say he does not. And that is why we are petitioning the United Nations.
However, President Yoweri Museveni, in a security address on Saturday, said these disappearances are not the culture of the current regime and army leadership. According to Museveni, the heavy deployment ahead of the elections was because he heard of plans by some lawbreakers to stop the elections.
And in the case of Kampala, we also brought a commando unit which had distinguished itself in fighting in Somalia and which had destroyed ADF. It was deployed in the Kampala area. And this group quickly defeated the terrorists who had started operating here. They killed a few who tried to attack them and arrested scores of those lawbreakers.
Heavy security was deployed and roadblocks were set up on the route leading to the UN Human Rights Office in Kampala. Six journalists sustained head injuries after being beaten by military police officers as they camped outside the offices. A UN human rights officer who preferred anonymity, speaking to VOA, said they would not comment about the petition since the cases are confidential. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala.
The United States Department of Defense Inspector General reports that the Taliban has maintained relations with al-Qaeda. The IG says al-Qaeda members have also been integrated into Taliban command structures. The news comes days after NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said that Taliban militants in Afghanistan must do more to meet the terms of a 2020 peace agreement.
The Taliban must reduce violence, negotiate in good faith, and live up to their commitment to stop cooperating with international terrorist groups.
The VOA Dari service recently spoke with Steve Call, the author of Ghost Wars, The Secret History of the CIA, Afghanistan, and Bin Laden, from the Soviet invasion to September 10th, 2001, for which he received an Overseas Press Club Award and a Pulitzer Prize. The conversation took place over Skype, and Call drew parallels to what took place in the 1990s.
Of course, no period of history is quite the same, and a lot, the world has changed. Afghanistan has changed a lot since the early 90s, but there are some parallels. One is that the international community was half-hearted about the political negotiation that followed the Soviet withdrawal from Afghanistan. The Soviets left about 2,000 advisors in Afghanistan after their formal troop withdrawal, so they didn't completely withdraw. But like today, there was an attempt with the United Nations involved to negotiate some kind of transitional government or stability agreement that might include President Najibullah and his, his supporters. But it failed. And what we saw was essentially a military solution to a conflict that was, very complicated. And I fear that today we're in a similar situation. Yes, there are still international troops in Afghanistan, but the great number of troops that was there just 10 years ago is gone. There's an international attempt at a political negotiation involving all of the parties in the hope that this will stabilize the country. But here's the parallel to the 90s that worries me most. There are too many parties to the conflict that seem to continue to believe that they can win the war, that there is a military solution possible. The Taliban certainly seem to retain that conviction. And in the 90s, we saw what happened. If you don't believe in compromise, if you don't believe in negotiation, if you really think you can achieve your goals by war, what you get is war. But we already know from the 90s and from the last 10 years that this war is too complicated for one party to win. And so I'm afraid of a situation where we go back to a civil war that has many sides and few constraints, and that too many Afghan civilians and the generation that grew up in the cities over the last 20 years, that they suffer the most. That, to me, is the nightmare scenario.
Call goes on to say that he's concerned about the possibilities of promises being made during the talks in Doha that resulted in the U.S.-Taliban agreement.
Seems like there were some promises that the Taliban made to reduce violence more than they have. At least that's what the Americans say. But we don't. The Taliban says they didn't make any such agreement. So there's some confusion there about a very important point, which is how much the two parties, the three parties, have agreed already to reduce violence, and who's breaking their promises.
Author Steve Cole spoke with the VOA Dari service. A Pakistani Taliban militant who is alleged to have shot Nobel laureate Malala Yousafzai has threatened a second attempt on her life, saying in a tweet that next time there would be no mistake. Twitter says it has permanently suspended Esanula Asan's account following the posting. Assam was arrested in 2017, but escaped in January of 2020 from a so-called safe house where he was being held by Pakistan's intelligence agency. The circumstances of both his arrest and escape have been shrouded in mystery and controversy. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. France's National Assembly on Tuesday approved legislation designed mainly to counter a rise in Islamism in towns and cities, which the government says threatens national unity. Reuters' Flora Bradley Watson has more.
The so-called anti-separatism bill strengthens the state's oversight of mosques, schools, and sports clubs. It also includes tough new measures against online apologists for acts of violence and cracks down on practices like forced marriage and virginity testing. The bill was brought forward by President Emmanuel Macron, who said it will strengthen the country's secular principles. His party said the need for such a law was highlighted by the killing of a schoolteacher in Paris last October. Samuel Paté was beheaded by a teenage Islamist after he showed cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad in a class on free speech. Less than a fortnight later, a church warden and two worshippers were killed in a basilica in Nice by a Tunisian Islamist. Guillaume Vité is from the president's ruling party.
The fight against separatism has long been an imperative of national interest. The tragedy has made it an urgent moral necessity. And so, what is in this bill? First, it guarantees our need for secularism after major advances in our public actions. Second, it protects victims of separatism, be it physically or online.
Tuesday's vote in the lower house was the first hurdle for a bill that's proved contentious on the left and right. Some on the left say it is an attack on France's 5 million Muslims, while critics on the right say it's too weak. Still, it sailed through with 347 votes in favor to 151 against. The legislation now moves to the Senate, where the centre-right opposition dominates. Its passage is seen as key to Macron's re-election hopes for 2022. French identity and domestic security are expected to be central issues in the presidential vote.
Reuters reporter Floor Bradley Watson. The U.S. Justice Department has indicted three North Korean computer programmers for trying to extort and steal more than $1.3 billion as part of a global cyber scheme that included the 2014 hack of Sony Pictures Entertainment. A Canadian-American who allegedly laundered some of the stolen money also pleaded guilty in the scheme. State Department spokesperson Ned Price.
North Korea poses a significant cyber threat to financial institutions. It remains a cyber espionage threat. It retains the ability to conduct disruptive cyber attacks. And several of those cases in the past are quite high profile and prominent.
The deadly winter storms that knocked out power for millions in Texas and other states have exceeded the worst case scenarios of many U.S. utilities. They also fit a pattern of worsening extremes under climate change and demonstrate anew that local, state, and federal officials have failed to do enough to prepare for greater and more dangerous extremes. The crisis sounded an alarm for power systems throughout the country about the need to prepare for severe conditions, even those that go beyond historical trends. Experts say that a lot more needs to be done to prepare better for the storms sure to come. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg on Wednesday proposed allies strengthen their commitment to deterrence and defense in order to even burden sharing among the 30-nation alliance. He said improving the ways allies contribute cash, military hardware, and troops to operate would not only improve the organization's capabilities, but be fairer as well. The meeting continues on Thursday. Ghana, like many African countries, is grappling with high maternal and perinatal mortality rates. A new app, Trimester Save, is looking to help expectant mothers and parents of young children save money and make mobile payments using their phones. For more insight, Africa 54's technology correspondent Paul Ndiho, via Skype, spoke with Dr. Elvis Kumaforsen, its CEO and founder.
You are saving a lot of lives in Ghana. You've come up with this incredible technology or application that you use to save lives. Can you maybe speak about that?
So Trimester Save was it's a solution that is premised on using financial tools to enable mothers achieve what we call financial birth preparedness. In short, Trimester Save is trying to improve on the financial situation of mothers and women in their reproductive age so that they can access better maternal health care. And we do bring technology into it where we have the technical term embedded finance, where they are going through, for example, a pregnancy, and as the pregnancy progresses, they are also achieving savings targets so that by the time their baby arrives, they also have enough funds to cater to the needs of themselves and their babies.
How are people embracing this kind of technology that you're bringing on the market?
The service that we offer is to go give financial literacy on a schedule, and also then allow them to onboard remotely so they don't have to move out there. there and there, they can open an account. Accessibility has been a key factor here. And then the next important thing I should say is what channel actually works, and that's USSD. I'll just describe it. It's when you use a short code, and then you have automated responses to the short code. So here, for example, we have one as *789*963#, and then there's a panel that opens, and you enter information, and eventually you get onboarded onto the program.
You've had an opportunity, both as a doctor and as a person in the tech space, to interact with a lot of women. What are some of the healthy concerns that they want maybe you to address as a medical doctor or using your technology?
They want better lives for themselves, and they want better lives for their children. Then they want this, if it's being solved by technology, for the technology to be simple. So you have mothers who want to be able to talk to a doctor on the mobile phone, do a booking and talk to a doctor, seek a second opinion if they want to, and be able to have the confidentiality of discussing issues that they would maybe find difficult to discuss in some of the clinics. So I would say their major concerns have been accessibility to alternative channels of healthcare, and then ease of use of technology, both to access healthcare and to access the financial services.
How much of an impact has COVID had on you as a practicing doctor and on this kind of business that you have, trying to help women?
Yes, COVID has been has had a lot of impact on what we do. First of all, we had to rethink the strategy of onboarding at the antenatal care centers. So COVID pushed us to go digital as well. The uncertainty around COVID made our deposit increase by 161% when all other savings products with the financial institution partners went down. The mothers who had a baby and knew that the baby would come out no matter what, tended to push money into their trimester savings account. So then they have the idea of insurance savings. And now we implement a service that we built for using AI to assess physical distancing, and indeed all the other protocols as we onboard, so we can do this safely and save lives.
Dr. Elvis Kumaforsen is the CEO and founder of Trimester Save. He was speaking with Africa 54's Paul Ndiho. Ailey is a documentary about the life and creative spirit of iconic African-American dancer, director, and choreographer Alvin Ailey. VOA's Penelope Pulu spoke with the filmmaker about how Ailey's modern dance reflected the Black cultural experience.
Gospels and blues informed Alvin Ailey's dance movements. Ailey was raised in poverty by a single mother in segregated Texas. His upbringing informed his choreography, a blend of modern dance and ballet, speaking to the Black experience. Using archival footage, filmmaker Jamila Wignott explores the influences behind Ailey's creative genius in her documentary, Ailey.
I really wanted to come at it in the way that Mr. Ailey came at it. And that was about, let's acknowledge that there is pain and struggle in this story, but let's also look at what are the essential things that keep us going, and where are the strengths, and what is true to the everyday experiences of being in this particular community.
Identity was a strong message. Being able to say through the choreography, I am was a very, very important theme that ran through the dances.
Wignut explains how Elvin Ailey's dance creation, entitled Revelations, expressed the communal joy Black people felt through dancing the night away and worshiping at church the morning after.
He wanted for every kind of audience to be able to come to a theater and experience a human story in the bodies of these people. And I think that's when Mr. Ailey talks about his work being universal.
His dance, entitled Cry, was dedicated to his mother and to motherhood at large.
The Black women who would encourage you, who would be there always, who were so supportive, I mean, that you could not fail.
What he's really trying to access and draw upon are these kind of women who have been the strength of a community, and certainly in his own life, being raised by a single mother for the vast majority of his youth.
No! Wignut hopes the documentary offers insight into Ailey's inner psyche. As a prolific choreographer of 72 dance works, as an aloof individual, and as a gay African-American who did not allow himself into permanent relationships.
He has this kind of heroic quality to him, you know, as well as these real human struggles.
Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
And you've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well and be safe.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States supports the Lebanese people in their continued calls for accountability and reform in Lebanon. On February 4th, Lachman Slim, an activist who courageously advocated for freedom of expression and civic participation, was found dead in his car in southern Lebanon. He had been shot 5 times. The United States condemns the brutal murder of Lachman Slim. A publisher and a documentary filmmaker, Mr. Slim was a Shiite who spoke out against the violent tactics of Iranian-supported Hezbollah in Lebanon. U.S. Ambassador to Lebanon Dorothy Shea noted the dangers he faced. Lachman Slim publicly and privately acknowledged that there were threats being made against his life, and yet he bravely continued to push for justice, accountability, and the rule of law in Lebanon. Secretary of State Antony Blinken referred to Mr. Slim's killing as a heinous assassination. In a statement, he said, "It is cowardly and unacceptable to resort to violence, threats, and intimidation as a means of subverting the rule of law or suppressing freedom of expression and civic activism. We urge Lebanese officials, including the judiciary and political leaders, to hold accountable those who commit such barbaric acts without delay or exception." Lachman Slim's body was discovered 6 months to the day after the horrific August 4th, 2020 explosion in Beirut that killed hundreds and wounded thousands of people. The domestic investigation into the explosion resumed this month. It is important the Lebanese judiciary demonstrate that it can act to ensure respect for the rule of law. In a joint statement, Secretary of State Blinken and French Foreign Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian reiterated their country's full, unambiguous support to the Lebanese people, including by extending urgent health, education, housing, and other assistance. The two officials added, however, France and the United States also expect rapid results on the inquiry into the causes of the explosion. The six-month anniversary of this tragic event underscores the urgent and vital need for Lebanese stakeholders to finally act upon the commitments they have made to form a credible and effective government and to pave the way for the implementation of necessary reforms in accordance with the aspirations of the Lebanese people, wrote Secretary Blinken and Foreign Minister Le Drian. Such concrete actions remain crucial for the engagement of France, the United States, and their regional and international partners to provide additional, longer-term structural support to Lebanon.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. We'll be right back.